This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Hi, how's it going? On the report, hunting seasons on wolves might cause the packs to prey on livestock. We'll take a look at the industrial chemicals used in nail salons and losing cultural knowledge about using herbs for medical home remedies.
We'd be walking through the field, and he would tell me what that was, and he would tell me different things, what you use this for, what you use that for. I had 100 questions. Boy, I was a kid, I had 100 questions.
But first, here are some of the stories we've been following. The Iowa caucuses are behind us, New Hampshire primaries on the horizon, and the presidential candidates have been talking about a lot of the issues they think will win votes: immigration, health care, the war in Iraq. But in the upper Midwest and parts of the Northeast, many people are just as concerned about the future of the Great Lakes. Andy Buxbaum is with the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes office. He says much of the region's future depends on how we take care of the lakes.
If you're a voter, when you walk into the primary booth, I think the first thing you think about is which presidential candidates have really talked about the Great Lakes. Because right now they're not even talking about them. And then the second thing you think about is who's made a specific commitment to fund the restoration and the protection of the Great Lakes.
The first thing we heard from any of the candidates about the Great Lakes was Democrat Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico, offhandedly suggesting the dry Southwest states tap Great Lakes water, a position he quickly retracted. The three Democrats from the Great Lakes states, Senator Barack Obama of Illinois, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York, and Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, did co-sponsor legislation that would tackle some of the major issues facing the Great Lakes. But on the campaign trail, the presidential candidates are not talking much about the wealth of water, wildlife, and commerce on those lakes. Andy Buxbaum says they should be saying something like this.
The Great Lakes are wonders of the world. They're an incredible resource, not just for the region, but for the nation, and because they're an economic driver for the region and the nation. So we can't afford not to invest in the Great Lakes. That's what we're looking for the presidential candidates.
Buxbaum says he just wants the Great Lakes on the radar scope of the presidential candidates, and he thinks that might be happening more in the near future, but not throughout the region. In Michigan, the primary election is controversial because the state moved its election date up to January 15th. The Democratic and Republican national parties, to say the least, disapproved, and many candidates are avoiding the state. So if Michigan residents want to hear what the presidential candidates have to say about the Great Lakes, if they say anything at all, chances are they'll have to listen for their comments in other Great Lakes states. Well, the price of crude oil has reached a record high. Everybody is feeling it. I mean, after all, prices at the pump are about a buck higher than they were a year ago. But some people are expected to feel this blow harder than others. Kyle Norris has that story.
A barrel of crude oil costs a record $100. Everyone is feeling the result of this rise at the gas pump, but researchers say it's hitting some people especially hard. Nancy Kane is a spokesperson with AAA.
Who it really hurts is really the quote-unquote working poor, the people that really are working jobs that are, you know, just making it, getting by week to week. They're spending more and more of their money, and they have less, you know, available cash than some other people do.
She says that rising gas prices link to rising grocery costs, which also have serious consequences for the working poor. For the Environment Report, this is Kyle Norris.
Environmental groups are lining up behind California in a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA is trying to stop California from mandating stricter greenhouse gas emission standards for cars and trucks. The Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense, and other big environmental groups have filed a petition with an appeals court. They want to overturn that decision by the EPA. As soon as President Bush signed the energy bill into law, the EPA administrator, Stephen Johnson, declared the new 35-mile-per-gallon standards in the Energy Act would reduce greenhouse emissions enough so that California's stricter emission standards were not necessary. Well, in response, California and 15 other states sued the EPA. California often leads the nation in stricter pollution reduction standards. The Sierra Club called the EPA's decision, quote, Another example of the Bush administration's bad habit of ignoring laws that it finds inconvenient, end quote. The EPA argues the better mileage standards will adequately lower greenhouse gas emissions because less gasoline will be burned. University students are sniffing manure samples in the lab. As Mark Brush reports, the students are part of a research effort aimed at reducing odors near livestock farms.
Students are paid $30 to take part in each sniff test. They tell researchers which air samples smell the worst. Researchers are trying to figure out how to cut back on smells coming from large livestock operations. Al Heber heads up the research at Purdue University. He says the studies help determine what practices cut down on smells, and it helps communities decide where to locate these big livestock operations in the first place.
We have used these odor emission studies to help develop a setback model so that if the farm is located far enough from the neighbor, then we can avoid the problem because we let the atmosphere dilute the odor down to where it's not a nuisance anymore.
Heber says using appropriate setbacks could cut back on the conflict between livestock producers and the people who live near them. For the Environment Report, I'm Mark Brush.
This is the Environment Report. Coming up, workers at nail salons are exposed to industrial-strength chemicals. There's a program trying to reduce the fumes and the hazards. But first, this story. This year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service plans to officially remove the Northern Rockies gray wolf from the federal endangered species list. The agency will hand over management of the wolves to states in the region. The states will allow hunters and ranchers to kill wolves during specific seasons or even year-round. But scientists and conservationists are concerned about the hunting plans. Kenna Oman reports some conservationists think hunting could disrupt the way a wolf pack works and even lead members to seek out easier prey, such as livestock.
Biologists in Yellowstone National Park have had an unprecedented opportunity to study wolves over the last 12 years. They've looked at everything from what wolves prefer to eat to why wolves kill big prey such as bison. But one topic they haven't studied much is how a typical wolf pack works. Doug Smith is a biologist with the Yellowstone's Wolf Recovery Program. He says they now understand healthy wolf packs need lots of older, skilled members in order to hunt natural prey.
They're very good at it. They have a lot of teamwork. They switch back and forth about who's doing what job.
In fact, studies have shown it takes 3 to 4 skilled adults to kill an elk. It takes even more wolves to kill a bison. Packs in Yellowstone are naturally filled with large numbers of adults, but in places where wolves are hunted by humans, skilled adults are in short supply. Smith says the lack of skilled wolves in a pack could mean they'd be more likely to go after easier prey, including livestock.
If they don't have that experienced age structure in the pack, they make do. And so you will have probably inexperienced killers out there, and inexperienced killers are going to look for easy prey. The elders of the pack, if there's only 2 or 3 of you, are much more likely going to go after a sheep or a cow than if there's 7 or 8 of you.
These concerns could become real when the gray wolf is taken off the endangered species list in the Northern Rockies. The states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming will take over management. Suzanne Stone with the Defenders of Wildlife in Idaho says hundreds of wolves could be killed as part of state management plans.
And they're talking about killing now 500, 600 wolves after delisting. You don't manage any population of wildlife like that. The delisting plan, as it's written right now, is just a recipe for failure.
Stone says the gray wolves were protected to build healthy populations, and how a wolf pack works should be part of that consideration. But the government is focused on how sport hunting affects just wolf numbers. Ed Bangs is a wolf recovery coordinator with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says that hunting won't threaten the wolves.
One thing that does happen everywhere in the world that wolves and people overlap is that people kill wolves. And the answer is yes, that does have an effect on wolf pack structure, and it certainly never endangers wolf populations.
So it's hard for conservationists to convince officials that the sport hunting of wolves could change how wolf packs work and even lead to more livestock conflicts. Biologist Doug Smith says that's because the decision to delist the wolves is based purely on numbers.
Delisting is entirely numbers. Some conservation biologists have made the argument that delisting should not occur until the endangered species is integrated back within the ecosystem and functioning as a member of that ecosystem. That is not how delisting occurs now for the Fish and Wildlife Service. It's, do we have enough?
Many conservationists and activists will soon be arguing that killing 500 to 600 wolves leaves too few. They'll likely file lawsuits stressing that the importance of healthy wolf packs should be considered before hunting is allowed. Ed Bangs with the Fish and Wildlife Service says he's confident the agency has followed the law. He says they'll meet the requirements of the Endangered Species Act by delisting the wolves and handing management over to the states.
My deal with the Fish and Wildlife Service is, what is the purpose of the act as it's currently written by Congress? Have we met those conditions for wolves? And the answer is clearly yes. And therefore, we're supposed to delist them. If people want the act to say something different, they need to talk to their elected officials, not to the Fish and Wildlife Service.
But the wolves' defenders will argue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as the states, need to understand how the wolf packs work before declaring open season on the wolf. For the Environment Report, I'm Kinna Oman.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. A little later, we'll visit a store where older African Americans go to find herbs for home remedies passed down to them. But first, this story. Anyone who's been in the same room as an open bottle of nail polish remover knows just how strong it smells. Now, imagine working in those fumes all day, every day. Well, that's kind of what it's like to work in a nail salon. And there's growing concern that nail salon workers are being exposed to such high levels of those fumes that their health is at risk. Anne Dornfeld reports on a project in Seattle to teach nail technicians how to keep themselves safe at work.
Connie Fields is at North Bend Nails today to get her nails touched up with liquid acrylic. It's been her ritual every 2 or 3 weeks for the past 20 years.
You know, I work a lot with my hands, and when my nails are done, it makes me feel good. You know, it helps complete my dress, so I like nails.
Still, Fields has her misgivings about the safety of nail products.
I've had concern, you know, because years ago, whatever the chemical they were using at the time, some girls had an infection.
It's not just the customers who are at a risk. The people who work with these chemicals day in and day out are the most exposed. Often, they're Vietnamese immigrants. It doesn't take long to get trained to do nails, and you don't need to speak much English. But language barriers can keep Vietnamese nail salon workers from learning how to protect themselves from workplace chemicals. You've probably noticed this sounds less like a spa and more like an auto body shop. That's how it smells, too. Salon owner Helen Huang is combining chemicals to create liquid acrylic for Connie Fields' nails.
I use two products for this. One product is mixed with powder to make the powder supple so I can paint it on. And the other one is a polymer to finish it off.
The odor is industrial strength. And Kevin Burrell says that's no exaggeration.
The chemistry that's used in the salon for doing nail finishes, they're very similar to the chemicals that are used in auto manufacturing.
Burrell is the head of the Environmental Coalition of South Seattle. He says most nail technicians don't realize that they're doing a small-scale version of auto painting with the same kinds of chemicals and technique, a primer, a base coat, and a top coat. Common chemicals in nail polish include formaldehyde and toluene. At high doses, those can cause respiratory problems, including asthma, headaches, and even organ damage. Burrell says acrylic nails might be even more dangerous.
They're made of two chemicals, one of which has been banned at full strength in our state. You can't use methyl methacrylate in Washington State at 100% strength.
But Burrell says products with 99.9% methyl methacrylate are still on the market. That chemical has been limited or banned by at least 30 states. Studies on animals suggest inhaling too much of it might cause respiratory and organ damage. A recent University of Toronto study showed that a group of nail salon workers' children had signs of learning disabilities linked to solvent exposure. And some studies show a chemical in nail polish called dibutyl phthalate may stunt the fetal growth of male testes. Burrell says to limit exposure, nail salon workers need to use safe chemical handling practices. So his organization is working on an education campaign called Toxic Beauty. It's funded by the Environmental Protection Agency. The campaign sends a Vietnamese-speaking educator into salons to show owners and workers how to protect themselves. At North Bend Nails, owner Helen Huang welcomed the advice. She already had a ventilation system and air conditioning.
There's probably just a few places that have ventilation systems because they're costly. It takes money to buy them and to run them. I don't know for sure, but my customers say the air is much better here than other salons.
She says the educator showed her some other ways to limit chemical exposure.
Before, I threw everything away in just the trash can. They told me to put everything in trash bags and tie them before I throw them away. Another thing they recommended was to install vacuums in the manicure tables to suck up the dust and fumes. I'm planning to do that.
Ultimately, environmental justice activists want nail salon workers and customers to demand safer nail products. Phthalates, formaldehyde, and toluene have all been banned by the European Union in nail products. So far, only one major company, OPI, has agreed to change its U.S. formulations, too. The demand has to come from the ground up. That's because the U.S. government doesn't regulate cosmetics for safety. For the Environment Report, I'm Ann Dornfeld.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Well, when most of us get sick, we go to the doctor and we get some medicine, a prescription of some sort. But some people are holding on to the old ways of healing, and many people think we could learn a lot from those old ways. Kyle Norris has that story.
The small store is called Nature's Products. It's in a neighborhood with a lot of abandoned buildings and storefront churches. When you walk inside the store, the smell of incense clings to your clothes. Green plants hang in the windows, and there are jars and jars of bulk herbs lining the shelves. Gary Wantage opened the store 30 years ago. He's always been interested in natural healing techniques and herbal medicine. Now, that all might sound New Agey, but this place is not New Agey at all. The reason Wantage opened the store in his hometown of Detroit was because he wanted to help the people who lived there.
In a lot of urban areas, people are very limited on resources. They're limited with money. They're limited with shopping resources. And this was one way that I tried to give back to the community.
Wanda just says that one of the main reasons he stayed in Detroit is because of his customers. They're some of his biggest teachers. Many of his customers are older African Americans. They came from the South to work in the factories during World War II. When they came, they brought with them a cultural knowledge of herbs and natural healing techniques. One of his customers is 72-year-old Faith. That's her legal name, just Faith. She grew up in a segregated farming community in Louisiana. Her father was a farmer, and he taught her all about herbs.
I am the youngest child of all, so I'm the baby. And I often would, he would often let me ride on his shoulder. And sometime, you know, I'd be saying, Papa, what is this? And he would tell me what that was. He would tell me, you know, we'd be walking through the field, and he would tell me what that was, and he would tell me different things, what you use this for, what you use that for. I had 100 questions. Boy, I was a kid, I had 100 questions.
She says back then, everyone knew about the herbs, and everyone used them. At that time, people who were poor or black or who lived in rural areas did not often have the option of going to a doctor. And so they turned to the plants and trees around them for medicine. And they developed a great knowledge about what did and didn't work to keep people healthy.
The pine tree was used for many things because it's one of the things where you get turpentine from. It was definitely used for healing. And we use turpentine for sores. And it works today. If you get a cut and you put turpentine on it immediately, soon after you hit it, it will never be sore.
Herbs were actually our first form of medicine. That's what Susanna Zick says. She's a naturopathic physician who teaches at the University of Michigan. She says we have a collective knowledge about herbs that's thousands of years old. She says when you compare that to what modern-day science knows about herbs, it's not much of a comparison.
In a sense, we have just a tiny little window that science shows us as compared to the long use.
Zick says we could learn a lot from these folks and the knowledge they have. But not many researchers are studying people like the customers here in Detroit.
I think that we can actually learn what herbs they're using a lot of and what for, because I think those are probably the ones that would be of most interest. In particular, it's a good question, too, if they're using them with conventional medications. It's for safety issues. But also, if this is their primary health care for some of them, if it's working, then this is a very inexpensive way of providing health care for people who might otherwise get none.
Everyone we heard from in this story said the same thing. For us to have good health, the old-school ways of healing can work hand-in-hand with modern-day doctors and science. But the people who know about herbs are growing older, and they're dying. And their knowledge is dying with them. For the Environment Report, I'm Kyle Morris.
And that's the Environment Report for this week. I'm Lester Graham. Mark Brush is my co-editor. Of course, he's the guy who'd uncover the story of students sniffing manure. He's the same guy who's done a story on livestock manure lagoons, sewer overflows, diapers. See a pattern here? Rebecca Williams is our chief reporter. She identified with the newscast story from Kyle Norris about gasoline prices hitting the working poor especially hard. I think that's a hint. Our production assistant is Leah Seifermann. She wants me to tell you about links and photos for the stories you heard on the report. You can find more information at www.environmentreport.org. And if you want to drop us a line, let us know what your views are, want to gripe about gasoline prices, or about getting your nails done, or maybe you've got stories about wolf hunting. Our email address is feedback@environmentreport.org. The Environment Report is a tiny little division of Michigan Public Media.
Support for Environment Report stories comes from the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Americana Foundation. Get more information about Environment Report stories at environmentreport.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.